Yo, hey, what are we watching today?
I believe it's, if I remember correctly, it's called Deliverance.
Deliverance. Wait, which one is that one again?
I think it's the one where they escape through some tunnels.
Tunnels? No, that was last week.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, wait, no, I remember now. That, I believe you got a pretty mouth.
Oh, well, thank you. Grab the popcorn.
All right.
Welcome to Grab Your Popcorn. I am your host, Brian Kroc. And along with me is, of course, David Fridge Kalisa.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. How are we doing?
Now, as some of you remember, we did a classic war film last week, and we had all set up to do a great comedy this time around. But something very, very interesting and sad happened, and that was we lost a great actor of our age, and that was Burt Reynolds.
Yes.
And so we called an audible, like literally Sunday, and we're like, hey, let's do a Burt Reynolds film. And so we are doing Deliverance today, which, if you don't know, was his breakout role. This was the one that really put him on the map as far as an actor goes.
Yes, I agree with that. And we chose this film also because, you know, we didn't want to go, you know, along with one of his main options that he might be more popular for, because
yeah,
that's just not what we do. We want to go with, you know, something a little bit more intriguing, a little bit more interesting, stuff that you may not know about him.
Yeah, I was talking about this beforehand with some of the coworkers, and this to me is the movie that was Burt Reynolds before he was Burt Reynolds. You know, before he got the mustache, before he was typecast as the super alpha male in everything.
On the other hand, though, he did set himself up to be the alpha male in just about every film he played, because who else can rock a leather vest with nothing underneath it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
I mean,
that's
you just don't get more manly than that.
That's, yeah, that kind of amazed me about this movie. But, of course, Deliverance is much more than just Burt Reynolds. It is a cast ensemble, you know, with four main actors, and... They all like kind of came into this movie without being known at all.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
I believe what was it? Ned Beatty and Ronnie Cox. This was like their first movie, like ever, really.
And you can really tell because you know, if you look at any of their later films and everything like that, they've definitely expanded on there.
Yeah, they were theater guys before that, which
right,
is where the director John Borman found them to begin with. But yeah, Ned Beatty and Ronnie Cox, who played Bobby and Drew. They don't really say their last names very much throughout the movie, but they're Bobby and Drew. And they all have like normal names: Ed, Lewis, Bobby, Drew. John Voight as Ed Gentry, and Burt Reynolds as Lewis Medlock.
Lewis.
He doesn't look like a Lewis, but man, he... Especially since it's spelled L-E-W-I-S. Like, if you're going to call him Lewis, it'd be like L-O-U-I-S.
The traditional way. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But the four main actors playing their respective parts. So let's actually get into the movie itself. Kicks off, like, right off the bat without any real, like, intro to anything. It's like, flash the logo, straight into the movie. And it's just dialogue with images.
And you have no idea where these guys came from, how they know each other,
yeah,
where they're even at, really. You just know what river they're going to.
Well, they say they're in Atlanta, so they do say that because it's all in Georgia, and that's where they're saying they're trying to get to. But you hear their conversations, like, between the four of them, and it's all, hey, let's get out there into the wilderness because they're about to dam up this river, and it's going to become no longer a live river. It'll become what they call a dead lake. And so they decide to go out there to canoe down the river, and along the way they run into some very interesting trouble. I will tell you this, just for a little bit more information, the movie was it was filmed in like 1971, and it was released in 1972. And the movie is just it's listed as a thriller.
Which, when you watch it, anybody that's seeing it for the first time, not knowing what it is about or what is going to transpire,
yeah,
I can definitely see that. I agree with that genre.
It almost starts off like a nature film. You know, it's just like, hey, we're gonna go out and explore the world. You know, but it definitely turns dark, and it's got a very big sense of brooding underneath it, especially with just their conversations and stuff like that too, as the crew go down this river. But yeah, so it starts off just with like all this images of this like wilderness and the show construction of a dam and all of that, and then it's them talking, and then like the first shot is them pulling up to this like shack gas station.
Which I didn't even know was a gas station. I thought it was really weird that he was telling the guy to gas up his car. I'm like, you're at the dude's house. What are you doing? That's so rude.
He's like, put gas in that one. And he's just like, okay.
I'm like, wow, either these people are really dumb or I missed something. But yeah, like, they are at a gas station.
The super nicest people on earth. Like, well, the guy told me to gas it up, so of course I went and got my can.
It's all about that Southern hospitality.
Yeah.
That is what they're known for.
Yes, yes. And but this entire setup leads to Ronnie Cox, his character, and I'm so bad, because these are also just like normal names. It leads to Drew tinkering around on his guitar when this kid all of a sudden walks out with a banjo and starts playing with him, and then this leads to the very, very famous scene of the dueling banjos.
Which is
not the correct name, since it's a banjo and a guitar.
And
but whatever.
And it's also, it's funny, but it's also kind of creepy, because the kid looks like he's from The Hills Have Eyes.
Yes.
And he was a local, like that, you know,
The director, like, went to the school and actually found all of these kids, and he was just like, you know, like, I imagine him just going down the line of kids, and he's just like, no, 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 yep, you look like an inbred kid.
Yeah, the majority of the actors who play the locals, they look like their family tree is a telephone pole.
Yes, he doesn't really, really look like that. He was just a weird-looking kid to begin with. The kid looks fine now.
No, but it sets up the precedent for everyone else that they meet throughout the film. Like,
yes,
you know, that is,
yes.
You know, I feel like that was done on purpose. But okay, if this is what just the kids look like, or like not even fully where they're supposed to be yet,
yeah.
What is everyone else going to look like that they're going to encounter?
Yeah, yeah. I believe Ned Beatty's character calls it a genetic deficiency.
Yes, yeah, he was the most politically correct in that.
Yes, so that was Bobby who said that. So yeah, this scene goes on for a long freaking time.
It does, and like, but that's what's kind of cool about this film, is that scenes like this are really, you know, what caused that brooding that you were talking about, because really don't know if it's going to lead to something funny, or if it's a dramatic buildup, or if it's going to be one of the traumatic events that happens. It's a complete mystery to the viewer, and I think that was really neat of how it was directed.
Yes. So it goes along from there. They end up meeting these guys after saying, hey, we'll pay you some money to go move our cars down to this other city, this other town, and then we're going to canoe down to that town. And it's all set up very nicely. They all get on their canoes, and there's some really great shots of them going down the river and going through some fast, you know, water areas and stuff. Looks a lot of fun. It's the kind of thing I'd like to do, so...
It was nerve-wracking for me. I mean, I'm pretty sure I would do it, but I'm watching. I'm just like, oh, my God. I'm just waiting for that thing to, like, capsize or do something crazy. I don't even know how they shot it. I can only imagine how many takes it took to get some of the scenes.
Yeah.
Or if they were able to somehow get them on the first try.
So I actually do know a little bit about this, because I research my movies whenever we do this. They actually shot these movies sequentially. One, so they shot the first scene that they shot was the dueling banjo scene. And then they shot everything basically going forward
in succession.
Two, they did all of that crap themselves. They did all those stunts themselves.
Well,
and none of them were insured.
Well, and that's
this is Hollywood filmmaking.
Well, that Burt Reynolds did say in the film, he just did not believe in insurance, which I felt was a very Burt Reynolds thing to say, because
which was
he's
thrown
just
in there, which is thrown in there because the actors didn't actually have insurance in the movie.
So it was a little jab.
It was a jab because that's why they threw it in there, just to be like, hey, la la la, that's funny.
It's neat that the director agreed to keep that in.
Yes. And then, and I do know that later on in one of the other scenes, going down a waterfall, they had originally put a dummy in the canoe and it went over, and Bert had said, "Hey, that looks like a dummy going over a waterfall. How about you let me do it?" So he jumps into the boat and then goes over the waterfall, gets capsized, goes underwater, and breaks his coccyx. Yeah, that's what he broke. And then, later on, he asked the director, he's like, "Hey, what did it look like?" The director goes, "Looked like a dummy going over a waterfall."
What an asshole. I'd punch you straight in the mouth if I broke something for that scene, and you told me I looked like a dummy going over a waterfall.
The best thing, though, is that I was looking into some of the other ones, too, that they did. And Ned Beatty actually, in one scene, fell out of the boat, got sucked under by a whirlpool, and mm-hmm. he was down there for like 30 seconds, and somebody actually dove in and had to rescue him. A production assistant actually dove in to rescue him. And Borman asked Beatty afterwards, "How did you feel?" And Beatty responded with, "I thought I was going to drown, and the first thought was, how will John finish the film without me? And my second thought was, I bet the bastard will find a way."
Alrighty then.
Borman's hardcore, man.
Apparently so.
This was before CG. They couldn't just fudge it. They just be like, "Oh, we'll just halfway through filming replace him with another actor and nobody will know."
That's a morbid thing to hear about, if that was going to be your last thoughts before you died.
That's a hardcore worker, too.
That's dedication.
That is absolute dedication. I loved it. The guys go on this thing and they come into their first spot where they're going to rest for the night and eat and sleep and all that. And they have a really interesting conversation about just different aspects of life. And, of course, it also sets up Burt Reynolds sort of just being a crazy person.
Well, he's ready for the post-apocalypse. He does not want – the man looking over anything. He just wants everyone to fend for himself.
Yeah.
And which is what he kind of already does out on these trips. Mm-hmm. You can tell that he is the reliable one, to man the boats and to do the fishing and everything like that. So he is ready for that world. He wants it to happen.
Yeah. But it's all very interesting. And you can kind of tell that after even the first rapids and stuff like that, Ned Beatty was, talking about he's like, "Hey, do you remember that one part that we were, blah, blah, blah?" And Reynolds is just like, "Yeah, no." It's like, this is what it's about, is living life in the world because we're alone. It just completely cuts him off.
It's like, alrighty then, I'm like, just going to leave you alone.
Like Ned Beatty's just like, "This was awesome." And Burt Reynolds is just like, "Life is meaningless.
It's not about being awesome. It's about being alone."
So, but this does set up a couple of really great things, too, because it showcases Burt Reynolds as Lewis using his bow and arrow to fish, which is really cool looking because it's a really cool looking bow. And then John Voight, After they spend the night, John Voight, of course, takes the bow, and he sneaks off to try and do a little hunting, and he can't do it. He can't kill the creature.
He can't bring himself to do it. And it's a real interesting thing, because even though it's such an intense scene, you are still left with wondering if something is going on with him, if he's too excited, because, people will get the buck fever,
mm-hmm.
and they just, they'll get so excited and their adrenaline gets going. And that's what causes him to miss. But you then come later to find out that, he is just not meant for that sort of life. That's why he goes out to do it on his own. That way no one's around to see him do it. And he can go back and kind of side with his friend Lewis about, well, this is what happens to guys sometimes and everything.
Yeah. So, you know, he has trouble killing the deer, but he goes back and, you know, they continue on with their trip. And this is where the guys get separated. And one boat's going along, the other boat's going along. They kind of get split up a bit. And this is where Ed, played by John Voight, and Bobby, played by Ned Beatty, they get a little caught up with some locals.
Yeah.
So these two dudes show up, and they're like, hey, we're heading down there. And they're just like, hey, no, you're not.
I got the shotgun that we're going to point at you, and we're going to hold you hostage, and we're going to do bad things to you here in these woods.
Which then leads to two of the lines that are said most, as far as I'm concerned, about this movie. And that is,
you got a pretty mouth.
And
squeal like a pig.
Yes. These two lines are still said in my office often. And it cracks me up.
I don't want to know why. It's a very open office. There's no privacy.
Yeah.
So I don't want to know why. And it's mostly dudes.
So, yeah, like these two hillbillies who don't have names in the book or in the movie, they take Ned Beatty, his character, and one of them proceeds to rape him. And then as they're about to rape John Voight's character, that's where Mr. Reynolds and his recurve bow shows up and drops the dude with the shotgun. And then Voight takes the gun from that guy and then tries to hunt the other dude down. But he doesn't succeed because he can't shoot him, even though he was like 10 feet away from him.
Yeah, it was, in my opinion, it was a very poorly shot scene. And I understand it was, that's how it was meant to be, but a little bit of the acting fell short, and it was just kind of like that could have been prevented.
Yes. Now, this is where I actually thought the movie, one, got really interesting, because acting-wise, this is where you see the real split in the group, where you've got Ronnie Cox, like, all of a sudden freaking out, basically saying, Lewis, you killed somebody, blah, blah, blah. And Reynolds' response to me was, she's perfect. It was just like, yeah.
Where's the law?
It's like,
where is it at?
But he's just like, yep, I killed him. What of it? It's like, boom, hardcore.
And so chill about it.
He's like
you know he's done it before. That's not the first person he's killed.
No. And it's like, you get that sense that he's just like this is what it is. This is how life exists without, you know, civilization. It's like, if they were going to kill you, I killed him instead.
And it's a very kind of harsh, subtle sense of truth.
Yes. And then, of course, afterwards, he rips out the arrow from the dude. And if you actually look at it, I mean, he's really struggling to yank that sucker out. Because, like, his arm's all, like, swollen up, and you can see the veins popping. And so he's just like, like, all covered in blood. Take the guy, bury him down this near the stream a bit.
Did not bury him very well.
He would have been dug up like that afternoon by an animal. So, that totally wouldn't have worked. And then this leads to the next sort of thing, because this, as a thriller, it can't just you know, be like one bad thing happens. This is then after that. Ronnie Cox's character is like kind of freaking out still. He doesn't put on his life vest. They run into some rapids. They crash both of the boats after Ronnie actually gets shot from a cliff.
See, that's not how it looked to me. It looked like he just sort of didn't like lose his mind, but he just didn't want to deal with it. It looked like he just purposely jumped out of the boat because he knew he wasn't wearing his life jacket and he would probably die that way.
Yeah.
And then later on in the scene where they, you know, or later on in the movie where they find his body, they look it over and they don't see a bullet hole.
Yeah. So, okay. So I'm looking it up because all I remembered was that Lewis believed that Drew was shot by the guy that got away. And now that dude is stalking them. So I could argue that he was shot because he knew that he was there and he was hunting them down with another gun.
Right. No, absolutely.
And so, and this led to them like trying to turn the tables on him and hunt him down. So this is actually one of the cooler parts of the movie for me, is because that was the scene where they went over the rapids and Reynolds like broke his tailbone. In the story, he breaks his leg and he's out of commission at that point.
Right, the person they rely on the most and that yes. saved them, he is now completely useless.
Yes.
He cannot move. Now, he's got bones sticking out the side yes. of his leg.
And John Voight is, like, his character is also a woodsman as well, but he's just not as, like, hardcore as Lewis is. And so he decides to kind of, like, hunt the other dude down, climbs up the cliff with the bow and arrow, and like, there's this really, really long scene, like, just on his face.
Oh, my God. My buddy and I were talking about that last night, and it was, like, going in and out, in and out. And it's like, how long did it take him to climb this mountain? How long does this montage have to be?
I swear to God, though, like, after he climbed up the top and he's, like, sort of against that rock, that it was, like, it was the longest shot on, like, a person's face that I think I've ever seen in a movie. I swear to God it had to be 2 minutes long of just on his face. Now, John Voight's acting is amazing during this scene, but it's still a really long time to be focused on one dude's face just making faces, like, as he's, like, climbed up this mountain. And then he falls asleep, wakes up, sees the dude, and he's like, all right, I got the drop on him. All I got to do is shoot an arrow, and I can't do it.
And then he.
Because I'm a human.
And then he channels his inner Michael J. Fox, and he starts shaking uncontrollably.
Yes. And this is where the gunman turns and sees him and is like, I'm going to shoot him. Then takes aim, fires. And John Voight releases the arrow, and he thinks that he's missed. And he goes up to him. And he's about to get shot again by the dude as he recocks his gun and he falls over with the arrow sticking out of his back.
Honestly, that whole scene reminded me when he's standing there shaking and you don't know who's going to fire first. I just thought of Blazing Saddles. And he's like, look at that. Steady as a rock. Yeah, but this is my shooting hand.
Yeah, that's kind of what it was. But it was just the fact that Ed there had to kind of overcome whatever fear or stuff that he was dealing with before, even just to save his own life. But even then, he kind of just accidentally kills the dude.
Yeah, because it was a lucky shot for being that scared and being that shaky. I mean, the accuracy was definitely not there. And that was just pure luck.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
the way.
All the way. And then this leads to really the kind of the emotional conclusion of the story, where they dispose of the body. They weight him down and throw him into the river. They get onto their canoe and they go down. They get to the city of Antri, and then Lewis is sent off to the hospital, and Ed and Bobby are left behind to kind of deal with the fallout of all this crap that has happened since Ronnie was never found.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They found him.
Yes, they found him.
But, you know, authorities didn't. So
yes.
Bobby is left to tell the story to the police of what happened and why and how and where their friend got killed.
And they didn't say anything about the people, like, hunting them down. They didn't talk about that. It was basically just like, oh, this dude, like, you know, he fell out. He must have drowned, blah, blah, blah.
Right. And then, and then Ed rides off with Lewis to the hospital to make sure he's okay. And
yes,
then we come to conclusion finale of the film.
So one thing I wanted to talk about, though, as far as like this finale, because there's quite a bit to unpack, is one, the scene where Bobby is at the table eating with the folks where they were staying at. And Ed walks up, and he's just, like, kind of stone-faced, and he doesn't really know what to do and all of that. And he sits down, and he like, starts to eat, and everybody's real quiet, and he starts crying. It was a powerful scene. It really was, because it's just like, oh, my God. Like, you know, it's like, you know, he's finally gotten to that moment where he's, like, having, like, a release of emotions because he's just been holding everything together as tightly as possible. And the thing that breaks it, though, is weirdly enough, is Bobby. Even though Bobby, like, I mean, he got raped by a dude like the day before.
Yeah, he should be the most emotionally broken out of any of them that are alive.
And he's not. He's actually just like, you know, his line is, it's like, man, there's like this corn is something special. And then it's corn, good corn. And then the lady like starts talking about the cucumber or whatever that she found. Or
it's like, yeah, I'm sure that's why you really enjoy that cucumber.
And it's just well, she was super old. So, I mean, I don't know about that, but yeah,
it was not subtly hidden like how she described it. And everyone's just sitting there
12 inches long and 10 inches around. So and she said it was the darndest cucumber you'd ever seen, something like that. I forgot precisely what she said, but it was just like Ed's just sitting there eating his food and everybody else is conversing. And then the scene a little bit after that, though, is where they are where Ed and Bobby are talking in the hallway. And he's basically just like, what did you do? Like, Bobby, you told them the truth, blah, blah, blah. And he's just like, I didn't tell him this, blah, blah, blah. It's like, and it leads to this really emotional confrontation. But what I loved about it, though, was once again, the acting on that part. And that is Ned actually like shoving, Bobby shoving Ed into the wall. And then Ed just like completely reversing it and then shoving him into the wall. And like them having this really intense emotional thing, and then this also goes to later on after that they go to finally visit Lewis in the hospital, and the cops are still trying to figure out what was going on. They figuring out what's happening and blah blah blah. And I believe the deputy or whatever is like, hey, my brother-in-law is missing, and they're just like, we don't know nothing about that. Like that, something different. Not
these are not the droids you're looking for.
So they're trying to figure out if this dude was killed or if it was an accident or if there's anything going on or if there's a tie between the two of them. And and they go and they visit Lewis, and he's like just staring at him intently, and he wakes up and he's talking there and the cop is there and he's just like staring, and they're having this internal conversation just like, do not say anything. Just trust us. We told them what we needed to tell them to get out of this. Just play along. Don't be it. And freaking Burt Reynolds, man, like is just a boss. And he totally gets it. He totally understands. And he's just like, what happened on that last rapid?
Oh yeah,
I don't remember anything.
Smooth as butter. Just like that's really what happened.
It's like I don't yes. remember nothing.
This is why you're my best friend, Lewis.
Nothing. That's it. That's the conclusion right there. But the thing is that's not where the movie actually ends.
No.
Because then Ed goes home and he's with his wife and kid, and he's like having nightmares about like a cold dead hand coming out of the water. Not like a scary kind of thing. It's just more like a hand popping out of the water. It wasn't like a grabbing, like Carrie at the end of Carrie.
Oh,
like the
yeah.
hand comes up and all that. You know, it's just like him sort of imagining that the body in the water and yeah. and that kind of stuff.
It's his emotional breakdown
yes.
at the end of the film. And it's still really gripping because, you know, everything that he had to go through, that led up to that mm-hmm. point, and everything that his friends went through. And, you know, he's
the loss of one friend
and the loss of a friend. So, I mean, you know, he has so many internal conflicts going on that really no person would be able to handle. And he has to keep all of it to himself.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he risks losing his family and going to jail.
Yes. Yeah. Because they technically did kill two people, even though it was done in self-defense. There was no real way to prove that could actually happen. But
and with them being out-of-towners, it would have been their word
yeah.
against the towns. And mm-hmm. the town, you know, being a small town, everyone knows each other. Like, there would have been no way, even with it being self-defense, that they probably would have
yes.
escaped that fate.
Yes. So that's kind of like where the movie ends, though. There's no real conclusion.
No, it's definitely a cliffhanger because you don't know whether or not the bodies do actually
yeah.
turn up. You actually do not know who the second person was that they killed,
mm-hmm.
if it was that sheriff's brother-in-law or if it was the person that escaped from the rape scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely open, and that's what's a little bit neat about the film, too, is the total mystery throughout it, the brooding throughout it. it's with you the whole entire way from beginning to end, and you just kind of get to make up your own ending. And some movies do it very well, other movies don't. Yes, I feel this movie did deliver it, though.
The sense of atmosphere in the film is present, like, constantly. And I think one of the reasons why it achieves that is because, one, there isn't a massive amount of dialogue. And you and I were talking about this, that actually the dialogue isn't exactly great.
No, the writing of the film was, in my opinion, subpar.
Yes.
There have been films made before and around the same time of this movie that have superb writing and dialogue.
The dialogue for this movie is really just the setup. And there's not a whole ton of character development throughout the movies. Or throughout the movie. But then again, I mean, this is like 2 days of these dudes' lives. It's going to be a little bit hard to like pack real character development into this short like story.
Right, right. 100% agree.
So the writing was definitely the weaker point. But the acting and stuff that goes along with it is just superb. Which leads to a lot of the development of that atmosphere. But one of the other major things that I noticed about the movie is that there really isn't a lot of music. There's no real, like, there are certain hits in certain spots, but there's the dueling banjos. Ronnie Cox sings a song on their first night camping. And then there's, like, little bits of music throughout there, you know, using different stuff. And at the very end, when the credits are not rolling, but when the credits are basically there, it's one long shot on John Voight in bed with his wife, and the dueling banjos song is playing again. And that's really it.
Yeah, no, there's no soundtrack to the film. And back then, you know, that was, you know, when a lot of, like, orchestras and everything were used for films, and there was really none, you know, just like you said there. You don't have background music going on. You don't have, you know, crescendos going on during, you know, really intense scenes. All you have is the sound effects of, you know, the woods around them and everything from them running and just the acting itself to look at.
Yeah.
Which is smart because I'm sure that was probably done on purpose. It allows you and makes you focus on the actors and on the movie itself.
Yes, yes. So that was basically... Like the, I mean, it had this great atmosphere that just was very brooding throughout the entire movie, and it worked very, very well.
Yes.
So that's it. Scene, roll credits, done and done. Let's get into a couple of the little factoids about this movie.
Hit me with them.
So I said it before. It was 1972 when it was released. It is based on a book by the same name, and as we talked before. The reason why it's called Deliverance, and they don't get into it in the movie, is because they were trying to get deliverance from, like, the modern stresses of the world.
They basically to unplug from society.
Yes, exactly. The movie was made with a budget of $2 million.
Which is hard to believe because it's not a lot of special effects.
Mm-mm.
You can definitely tell it's a little bit of green screen because the driving scenes are just hysterical.
Yeah, and that's not
you see Burt Reynolds just jerking this wheel back and forth, and nothing on the screens is going anywhere. It's like, who the fuck taught you to drive?
That's not even green screening, man. That's literally just like, hey, like, we got a projector like in the background. Like, you know, they're just moving along. Just doing his thing. It made in the U.S. It made $46.1 million, which makes it a huge box office success at the time.
Oh, that, even by today's standards, that's a huge box office success.
Yeah, I mean, $2 million into $46 million, and so that was really, really good. The movie is, it's 110 minutes long, and it really is like start to finish. I mean, like from the second after the logo for was it Warner Brothers or whatever? Warner Brothers shows up. Like that's when the movie starts because there's talking like almost immediately.
Yeah, there's dialogue going on while they have this little montage of the dam being built and everything.
Yeah,
kind of confusing.
It is a little confusing.
You have to give it, you know, I'd say probably about two or three watches because then you're not fully trying to pay attention to one thing or the other. You can focus on the dialogue and everything. And then you also know the characters and who's saying what.
Yes. So, Yeah, but even then, like, to, like I said, where the credits roll and the last thing, like, that you see is John Voight just laying there, kind of staring off it in the distance. And it doesn't freeze. It's not like it's a frozen shot. It's literally just him.
No, because you, you see him blink and everything.
And he's, like, looking around and he's, like, trying to deal with, you know, the crap that he went through. So, yeah, I mean, it's a solid 110 minutes, and it's, like, from start to finish. There's no just, like, oh, here's the credits and here's the end of this and blah, 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 blah. But they, that's really it. It was filmed in, parts of, North Carolina and Georgia or South Carolina and Georgia. I'm looking it up. Say something, Fridge.
Hello.
I need you to talk longer than that so I can freaking read. let's see. Okay. So it was shot in Rabun, County in northeastern Georgia. The canoe scenes were all filmed in Tallulah Gorge, southeast of Clayton, and the Chattooga River, which is, and part of it was in sort of South Carolina and Salem, South Carolina, all that. So a couple of things that I do know about this movie is, one, in the years following the movie's release, more than 30 people died actually recreating the journey down the river. Because they saw the movie and they're like, yeah, I want to go do what those guys did. And it's like, did you not see the part where the dude got raped and they were being hunted down? Did you miss that part?
This wasn't a happy-go-lucky kayaking film. I mean, they didn't find a pot of gold at the end of the river. They didn't really get deliverance from too much. They still had to deal with quite a large amount of stuff.
They did not get delivered from anything except Ronnie Cox was delivered from his life. Okay. That's just how that worked. So the river that they talk about, though, is that it was a fake river that they just named it, you know, whatever. And the other thing that I know is that after the movie was released, the camping industry in Georgia almost died.
Oh, because nobody wanted to be in the woods to get raped.
Nobody was like, we're not going out into those woods. It's like, there you go. There's the 99% of people who saw this movie and were just like, I am not going into the woods to get raped by some moonshiners that have no teeth, okay? Ain't doing it. And then the other 1% were just like, I'm going to go down a frickin' canoe. You ever been in a canoe before? No.
Let's try it out, though.
Let's go. We're going to get it delivered. And they got delivered, too, from their lives.
I wish I could be delivered from your shitty puns.
those are the two random things that I know about this. As far as the actors go, they gave, like, the lead roles to practically everybody, and they all just turned them down. Originally, the director, like, wasn't even supposed to... Borman wasn't actually supposed to direct it. It was supposed to go to Sam Peckinpah, and he turned it down. They wanted Gene Hackman to play Ed and Marlon Brando to play Lewis. Jack Nicholson was considered for the role of Ed. They tried to give it to Donald Sutherland and Charlton Heston, and even Robert Redford, Harry Fonda, George C. Scott, and Warren Beatty. Yeah.
So pretty much everyone in Hollywood at the time.
Everybody was just like, no, bye. And so that's where they cast John Voight and Burt Reynolds in the two leads of the story as far as they're concerned. I would say that John Voight's character is a little bit more of the lead than Reynolds' character, but they are definitely the leads of the film.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that, especially with, you know, like we discussed, Burt Reynolds' part being laid up for the last about third of the film.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't have much screen time after that. He's kind of laying around and, you know, agony for most of it. My buddy and I, we were joking that, you know, he was probably just drunk on set and he woke up in a boat. Like, I'll just go back to sleep. We're filming right now. We'll let you know when it's done. Okay.
So, they offered it to all these different people and everybody turned it down. And that's when they were just like, John Borman was like, all right, well, I'll get some people who aren't known. And so he cast Reynolds, who had done TV work and like a couple of Westerns and stuff like that beforehand, but he wasn't an exceptionally well-known actor. And in fact, Reynolds was quoted later on saying, the biggest curse in Hollywood is being a well-known unknown. Being that actor that everybody can recognize, but nobody can actually remember their name.
Oh, that guy.
That guy. Which, if you or actually, if you're wondering, there's a great documentary called I Know That Guy or something like that. You can find it on Netflix, and it's basically interviews with all of these actors that you see in 1,000 different movies, but nobody really knows like what their actual name is. It's like, oh, this guy, he looks like an FBI like director. Like, we're gonna stick him in every movie that involves an FBI director. It's like, and you don't know what his actual name is.
Hey, you know, if it pays the bills, I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, the one guy that I actually knew who was like in that sort of a category was a guy named Pete Postlewaite, and is a British actor, and he shows up in a crap ton of movies, and you'd recognize him instantly if you saw him, but nobody ever really remembers his name. And but he was so good.
How the hell does no one remember his name? Postlewaite.
I know exactly.
That's fake. That's like Chef Boyardee's cousin.
Yeah, he was a great, great actor. So he died several years ago, though, unfortunately. So the cast two relative unknowns. John Voight's last movie was so bad that he actually thought that it ended his career. He was like, my career is absolutely dead now because I did this other movie and everyone said that it was a complete and total failure on every level. And then Borman cast him in Deliverance, and you know, now he's freaking John Voight.
Yeah.
You know, like going off and doing 1,000 movies after that and TV shows and everything he seems to stick his, you know, head into, he turns out to be a pretty decent film, or at the very least he puts in a good role. So
exactly, he's a versatile actor. I mean, what do you expect from it?
Very, very versatile actor. And of course this launched the careers of, well, Ned Beatty to begin, because he went on and did a crap ton of stuff too. Ronnie Cox became the quintessential bad guy in the 80s, like for a ton of different movies, and kept going off, and now he mainly does voice acting. And then, of course, it launched the career of Burt Reynolds, who unfortunately passed away this last week. But man, did he have a career!
Like he'll have one of the top Hollywood careers for many, many decades to come.
Yeah,
there'll be very few actors or actresses that will top that, or you know, get in that same sort of echelon.
Yeah.
of acting career.
Like, it's Burt Reynolds. Like, he basically, after that, you know, he got the other roles that made him, like, even more famous as Burt Reynolds. He did get typecast, though, after that, for the most part, up until he was cast in like, Boogie Nights and all of that.
Which is probably one of my top three films for Burt Reynolds would probably have to be Boogie Nights. And then it's a tie between this and Smokey and the Bandit, mm-hmm. varies on which one. And then thirdly is a very, very underrated B-movie from the 90s called Cop and a Half.
Yeah, Cop and a Half. God dang. Going back there on that one.
I could still watch that movie and laugh my butt off at it, because the camaraderie between him and that little kid is just hilarious. And, you know, he just has his great one-liners, and he's still aged so well. He's got that just badass dad cop look about him and everything like that, with his snakeskin boots and everything. It just, like I said, I doubt that'll ever leave my repertoire of favorite Burt Reynolds films.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Boogie Nights was a brilliant role for him. I of course, loved him in Cannonball Run. And he just, I don't know. He's one of these actors that you could basically, he could show up in any movie and you're going to be like, okay, that's a decent, you know, he puts in a good job.
Well,
like,
and a prime example of it, which, you know, is, you know, the comedy, the reboot of Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah.
You know, he played Boss Hogg.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, for the actors that were in that and everything, you would not expect him to, you know, be on that, but he totally nailed that part. Mm-hmm. I thought he was hilarious in it. And, you know, he just had that badass Texan about him, mm-hmm. you know, he pulls that off very well in his whole get up through the whole film. He just nails every bit of it. And it's just like, for being Burt Reynolds, you know, you would not expect him to show up in that sort of comedy, but he did, and he nailed it. And that's what made him one of the greatest actors.
Yes. So, he's been in a ton of different stuff. Let's see, he was in Boogie Nights in 97. He was in Magnolia in 99, which was a great, great movie.
That's considered a cult classic now.
Mm-hmm. He generally showed up a lot in like just sort of like minor roles, you know, like he would just show up in a movie randomly, like, you know, just as almost like a cameo for a lot of different things. But his last movie that was released was actually called The Last Movie Star.
Which I have not got around to watching yet.
And I really, really, I wanted to see it before he died even. Because I saw the premise of it, and I was just like, man, that seems like it'd be a solid role for him to do as, like, an aging actor who, you know, obviously his glory days are behind him, but he, you know, gets caught up in this last, like, run of feeling like a celebrity. And it seemed very, very interesting, and I definitely want to watch that one now.
Did you ever see any of the episodes where, like, him as himself appeared in Archer?
No, I've not seen those ones actually.
Oh my ever living God. It's hilarious because throughout the whole series itself, Archer himself, he calls Burt Reynolds his spirit animal.
Yeah.
For his,
but didn't,
you know,
he also role. Like question whether he's his father and stuff like that at some point too?
Kind of, but you know, just cause you know, Archer always considers himself like the badass spy agent, and
yes,
that only Burt Reynolds could be that badass.
Yes.
But what's great is that eventually in the series, his mom, who is his boss, ends up, you know, getting Burt Reynolds to be her date to this movie premiere thing, and then something happens, and then he has to hijack a car, and Burt Reynolds just so happens to be in it, and he gets to go on this high-speed chase with Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
And it's a horrible line. But, like, Burt Reynolds asked him a question. He goes, hold on, I have to get over my raging boner right now or something like that, because he is just so excited that he is with Burt Reynolds. And so, but he actually became a recurring character and voiced his own character, because he then actually started a relationship, like, you know, became boyfriend-girlfriend with Archer's mom.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, that, of course, caused conflict with Archer because he doesn't want anybody to be with his mom, but if anyone's going to be, it's Burt Reynolds. But it was just really cool to see, like, okay, so they got him to do one episode, but then he must have enjoyed doing it so much and, you know, working with them. He actually became a semi-recurring character in some of the series. So when you get a chance, highly suggest watching it and looking those up and everything.
I absolutely will. So, that kind of concludes our general review and overview. We didn't really talk about John Borman, but John Borman actually is a friggin' amazing director. If you ever get the chance, check out a lot more of his other films. He's over the top, brilliant director. And this just happened to be one thing that he ended up doing. We also didn't talk about the fact that the writer is actually in the movie. He plays the sheriff in the film. He was the writer of the book. He was the screenwriter, and he was always there on site to sort of keep everything moving along, which Borman hated. But you know,
well, I mean, I kind of hate too, because you know, as I stated before,
was the weakest part.
Writing was the weakest part, so therefore he was the weakest link of the film and should not have been involved as much
but
as he was.
Weirdly enough, he was a good actor actually, which cracked me up. That I thought was funny. So, let's see. We're going to rank this movie, all right? Okay, we're going to do a standard 10, all right?
Okay.
10 being, you know, greatest movie of all time, like, level, and 1 being, you know, Crossroads with Britney Spears.
Hey, what's wrong with Crossroads?
With Britney Spears. I'm not talking about the great Crossroads movie with Ralph Macchio. I'm not talking about that movie. I'm talking about the really crappy movie starring Britney Spears and a lovable Anson Mount. Hey, I've met Anson Mount, okay? He is a cool dude.
Well, you know, if he's so cool, I'm sure he had a lot better vision for Crossroads, and it's not as shitty a movie as you think it is.
An actor told him to do the movie, and it was like, it was somebody that he really respected. I want to say it was like Jack Nicholson or something like that. It was basically just like, it's like, no, you should probably do that movie with Britney Spears because my daughter like loves her.
And
so,
you know what? Jack Nicholson is probably just being a dick because he's known for that too. He's just like, that movie's going to suck, but you're still going to be in it.
Yeah.
And then he lit up a cigar and then went to a Lakers game.
Yes. So yes. So a scale of 1 to 10, where would you rank this movie?
I'd give this a solid 7.5 or 8. And yeah, obviously the points that are missing are going to be with the writing of it and just some of the shots that were put in there for filler, maybe just a little bit too much, and cut down about 10 minutes out of it, make it a solid hour and a half film.
Yeah, there was some editing choices that would have made the film flow a little bit better. There was, some slightly improved dialogue would have been really nice too. I know they were filming very quickly and without insurance, so there was that. But yeah, some editing choices, some writing choices, and I think the movie would have been better overall. But I mean here we are commenting on a movie from 40 plus years ago. So
therefore it has to have some good still going for it.
Yes.
This should definitely be a movie that everyone should at least have in their
Absolutely.
Watched library.
This is one movie that everyone should see just because it's a classic film, and I give it a solid 7. So you go 7.5, I go 7, 7.25 is what
we're really
call
close.
It, so.
We're really close to each other.
Yeah, we both agree on this one as far as that movie. There were some film mistakes as far as storytelling was concerned, but the acting is amazing and the cinematography was actually really well done as well.
Absolutely.
And the story itself is one of these types of stories that I like to say is a self-contained moment in life. And that is, it starts very generically just saying, hey, we're going on a trip. And then it ends with, very shortly afterwards with people dead, with people having to deal with emotional trauma and all sorts of other bad things. And yet the movie still kind of concludes with, yeah, but life is still going on. That dam is still going to get built. The river is gone, and there's nothing you can do about that. It's like, this is just what happens in life. Things progress.
It's a lot of depth for a movie that's just over an hour and a half long.
Yeah, exactly. It's a deep film, and it's very minimal, and it works extremely well for what it is. And so that's why I give it a solid 7, because there were mistakes, but the movie overall is something that should be experienced at least once by a person who would claim to love film.
1,000% agree.
All right. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed this, our review of Deliverance, starring John Voight and some other people, Ned Beatty, Ronnie Cox, and, of course, Burt Reynolds, who will be greatly missed. But he has left us a vast library of things that we can watch him in, which is great.
And please use your resources, go online, find out what all these other actors have been in. That's
yes.
Like, great source of, what we use. That's why we have such great love for movies and everything like that. We always highly suggest, doing your research as well. And, that way you get to see some stuff that maybe you didn't hear about or know about.
Yeah.
And feel free to let us know what you think about it, too.
And also, don't forget to grab your popcorn.
He got a little pretty mouth, ain't he?